again. That's coming up at 7 o'clock this afternoon on Fresh Air. It's 2 minutes after 4, and this is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Just a couple of minutes, we're going to be with Joe Klein, who's written a very new, very interesting biography of Woody Guthrie. And in a way, it seems like we'll be drastically changing musical directions, but in another way, as Joe Klein was just pointing out, there's a lot of similarities between the kinds of music that they wrote and the source that their music seemed to be coming from. So we'll be talking about Woody Guthrie in just a moment. But let's listen to one of his records first. This is one of probably his most famous songs. It's called I Ain't Got No Home in This World Anymore.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore. My brothers and my sisters are stranded on this road, a hot and dusty road that a million feet have trod. Rich man took my home and drove me from my door, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore. Was a farming on the shares, and always I was poor. My crops I lay into the banker's store. My wife took down and died up on the cabin floor, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore. As I look around, it's mighty plain to see this world is such a great and a funny place to be. All the gambling man is rich and the working man is poor, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
Woody Guthrie is singing one of his very famous songs. In 1977, Joe Klein wrote a feature story for Rolling Stone about Arlo Guthrie. At the time, it said his image of Woody Guthrie was one of a country hobo who rode around the country on boxcars and wrote ballads of social significance. He says that there was also a coying, cutesy, unduly optimistic image he associated with Guthrie. But as Klein researched Arlo Guthrie, he was constantly confronted with the fact that Woody's story had never been adequately told. This eventually led to Klein's new biography called Woody Guthrie, A Life, which has just been published by Knopf. It's a very thorough biography covering Woody Guthrie's roots in Oklahoma, his travels around the country, his music, his personal life, and his death from Huntington's chorea. Welcome to Fresh Air, Joe Klein.
It's good to
Very
be here.
Nice to have you here, and I enjoyed your book. Tell us a little more about how you got interested in Woody Guthrie, and I'd really be interested in hearing how your opinions of him that you held before you did any of this research were changed through the process of finding out about him.
Well, as you said and as you implied, I didn't know much more about Woody Guthrie than anybody else. It was that really powerful kind of ultimate adolescent image of him. And I was asked by the family, by Marjorie Guthrie, after that story about Arlo came out, I was asked by Marjorie and by Harold Leventhal, who was Arlo's agent, Woody's agent, if I'd like to write this. And my first thought was, there must have been 12 books already about Woody Guthrie, but there had never been a one. And then my second thought was, well, I don't want to write a book where every third word is rambling. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that his life was not only a phenomenal life, starting on the frontier and ending in a mental hospital in Queens, but it also, helped to illuminate a lot of cultural aspects of, American history that had been kind of submerged during the McCarthy era, helped to illuminate the whole culture of the American left that was very, that really had a major impact on the country in the 30s and 40s. And so I became interested in it, and I started to do it.
Having gone through all this research and interviewed a lot of people about his life, I'm sure you also spent a lot of time listening to his records. How do you feel about his music now?
Well, his music was, I was just sitting here listening to John Lennon sing, and the thing that really struck me was that Woody's the source of Woody's creativity and Lennon's creativity comes from the same place, which was a kind of primal anger. I guess, Lennon went into primal scream therapy and Woody went into the Communist Party. But in both cases, it was a kind of reaction against respectability. Lennon's father left when he was 3 years old. His mother died when he was very young. Woody's father was an outrageous frontier character, and his mother had Huntington's disease and was known as the crazy lady in town. Woody's father was an alcoholic, and the respectable people in town kind of sneered. The town was Okemo, Oklahoma. They kind of sneered at Woody's family, and the reaction against that kind of respectability really fueled Woody's creativity over the years. Song like the one we just heard, I Ain't Got No Home in the World Anymore, in this world anymore, was a pure screech of anger. I mean, that song, the etymology of it, I guess, is that there was a Carter family song that was very popular in the migrant farmer camps of California in the 1930s called This World Is Not My Home, meaning that the next world is my home. We don't have to worry about the fact that they're treating us awfully, we're starving, the babies are dying and things like that. Don't worry about that. The next world is the where it's all going to happen. And that outraged Woody. It really grated on him, and he turned the song on its head. Instead of "This world is not my home," it became "I ain't got no home in this world anymore because the landlord took it, and my wife is dying on the floor, and the police beat me up wherever I go to try and find work." And a lot of Lennon's most creative work, the work that I like most of his, comes out of that kind of anger. And the other thing that they really had very similarly was the ability to sublimate anger into humor, to use humor to communicate anger. And in that way, I guess, you can't say that Woody is cloying or cutesy the way the kind of image was. The music is a lot more profound and tough and humorous than that.
I think there's a musical example we can play here which will tie in a lot of the things you've just been discussing, and that's the Dust Pneumonia Blues, which is also a comment in a way on another pop song of the time. Maybe before we hear it, we could just talk a little bit about how he reacted to the popular music of his time. Do you think he saw himself as being the meaningful, angry alternative to the pie in the sky popular lyrics of the time?
He was Shakespeare in overalls. He was the Marxist alternative to Tin Pan Alley. The song that we're going to hear, Dust Pneumonia Blues, one of the, I guess, the early influences on Woody, aside from his mother, was Jimmy Rogers, who was really, one of the founders of country music, and that country and western music, and that he took the traditional songs and he added on things like Hawaiian bands, so that the pedal steel guitars came in. Sometimes he'd have Dixieland bands playing in the background, and he yodeled. I mean, who yodeled? People who sang traditional songs didn't yodel, except people who sang traditional songs in Switzerland. And Jimmy Rogers sang a song called about California, in which he said, "I'm going where the water tastes like wine." And thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people from Texas and Oklahoma in the 1930s left because of that song, because they wanted to go where the water tastes like cherry wine. And as we'll hear, the when Woody got out there, he was one of the thousands upon thousands who left. The water tasted like something quite different.
Like water, I guess.
Like turpentine.
Right, that's right. Well, let's hear Woody Guthrie's Dust Pneumonia Blues. And there's a reference in the lyrics to yodeling and how there should be a yodel, but there's not going to be one, and you'll hear why in the lyrics.
I got that dust pneumonia in my lungs. I got the dust pneumonia in my lungs. And I'm gonna sing this dust pneumonia song. I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, my son. I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, my son, you got that dust pneumonia, and you ain't got long, not long. Now there ought to be some yodeling in this song. And there ought to be some yodeling in this song. But I can't yodel for the rattling in my lungs. My good gal sings the dust pneumonia blues. My good gal sings the dust pneumonia blues. She loves me 'cause she's got the dust pneumonia too. If it wasn't for chopping, my hoe would turn to rust. If it wasn't for chopping, my hoe would turn to rust. I can't find a woman in this black old Texas dust. Down in Oklahoma, the wind blows mighty strong. Down in Oklahoma, the wind blows mighty strong. If you want to get a mama, just sing a California song. Down in Texas, my gal fainted in the rain. Down in Texas, my gal fainted in the rain. I throwed a bucket of dirt in her face just to bring her back again.
Woody Guthrie is singing the Dust Pneumonia Blues, and my guest is Joe Klein, who's just written a new biography of Woody Guthrie called Woody Guthrie, A Life, and it's just been published by Knopf. Well, the song that we just heard has lyrics about the dust bowl and dust in the lungs, so maybe this is a good time to talk a little bit about the situation in Oklahoma when Woody Guthrie started to leave it, and a lot of other people, as you mentioned, were leaving there too for places like California.
Well, the interesting thing is that the Dust Bowl really didn't have that much of a part, as much a part in Woody Guthrie's life as everybody has been led to believe, or even that he would lead you to believe, because he was living in a fairly prosperous town in Pampa, Texas, and he was kind of a, well, when I went back there to talk to people about him, they would all describe him as the first hippie they ever met, because he was probably the only Buddhist in the Texas panhandle at that point. He was into meditation and yoga, and he was burning incense in a little shotgun shack that he lived in. And he made his living by, you know, playing the guitar a little bit and drawing cartoons and doing portraits and telling fortunes and working as a soda jerk. And was kind of resented by a lot of his friends for that, because he could have made so much money, made money so easily. He kept on getting job offers. He would do sign painting, and he did it very, very successfully. He would paint, you know, these big advertisements on walls and make them up himself. And like he did one for a bacon company, and a sales rep was coming through town and immediately offered him a job in advertising. And that would happen continually, and he'd keep on turning it down. And so as the country went through this massive shock of the Great Depression, Woody kind of, you know, you know, didn't notice it, if you could even say that. He just, at least not until later. And in many cases, it took actually seeing it when he got out to California years later, to seeing the horror in the migrant camps and hearing the stories from the people in the migrant camps to really bring him around to it. Although he did experience some dust storms. There was one on April 14th in 1935, the great dust storm that was, you know, a remarkable disaster where, you know, the temperature dropped 50 degrees in a half hour, the humidity dropped to 1%, and it was just a swirling cloud of dust. You couldn't see anything. And he began those kind of experiences, started him writing topical songs like So Long It's Been Good to Know You. One of his most famous songs was a song about that dust storm. In those days, another thing I should say is this, that a lot of, you know, the Dust Bowl caused a lot of the migration to California, but there was another more economic reason for it, and that was that those small family farms, even in areas where there weren't dust storms, in Oklahoma and Texas and so on, were becoming uneconomical, and the banks were foreclosing on it. And the farmers were, you know, and farming was becoming corporatized during those years.
You give a sense of how many homeless people there were when you write, with all the homeless men cluttering the roadside, it became difficult to hitch a ride. It's such a romantic image to think of Woody Guthrie jumping boxcars all around the country.
It.
Yeah, because, I can think of a handful of people who tried so hard to emulate that life. And so this was not choice for him. It was
no. Necessity. He did it. He would have much rather hitched rides. But it was in the way he presented himself to the world. He made it seem as if he did it by choice. That he, you know, years later, when Alan Lomax discovered him and he went down to Washington to record for the Library of Congress, Woody wouldn't eat at the dinner table. He would, you know, kind of slurp up his food standing over the sink, and he wouldn't sleep on a bed. He'd sleep on the floor because he said, "I'm a road man. You know, I can't stand that kind of comfort." But it was a kind of pose that he put on for the world, because he found that it's a, you know, great American tradition of playing the rube, playing the country guy, dating back to Mark Twain and Will Rogers. Woody found that kind of pose worked. But he was really a lot more sophisticated than that. When he was still living in Pampa, Texas, he read out the library. You know, he was very well versed in psychology and religion and in a lot of different fields, biology. He had read all of his father's law books. And his letters, his writings, when he isn't on, when he's just writing to his family, he never misspells words, and his grammar is perfect. And he writes beautifully when he doesn't have to put on that oaky front for the rest of the world.
Sure, well, most people connect him with that kind of oaky, authentic folk tradition, but do you think he thought of himself as coming from a tradition or of constantly having his roots back in Oklahoma with his own people?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent he did. I mean, and to a certain extent he manipulated it. I think that the feelings about learning the music from his mother and the value that he placed on that music were very strong. I mean, there were a lot of people during those years that learned those old songs from their mothers, because that's the way it was passed, usually by women, from generation to generation. And most of the successful country musicians at that time kind of moderated that, you know, with pop influences and so on. And what made Woody Guthrie so significant was that he didn't. He was like a pure 19th century or 18th century balladeer. He didn't moderate it at all, and so he really placed some kind of inherent value in that traditional kind of music and in that tradition and in his roots.
One of the ways he became known in California was through a radio show that he did that was called Here Comes Woody and Lefty Lou. And tell us who Lefty Lou was, because you were telling me that she's still living and that you interviewed her for the book.
Well, Lefty Lou is a woman named Maxine Chrisman who currently lives somewhere in the San Fernando Valley in a little ranch house with her husband, who works at Universal Pictures. And in those days, she worked in a dress factory when Woody found her, and they sang together very well. And they got a radio show on KFVD in Los Angeles. And the distinctive thing about the radio show was that they played traditional songs almost entirely. Their audience was an old audience, an elderly audience. Most of the younger people wanted to hear cowboy music, which was very popular in Los Angeles during the 30s, or pop music. And Woody first began to endear himself to the Okies, to the people that had lost their farms, through this radio show by singing the old songs. I mean, Lefty Lou kept all the letters that they received during those years, and they were invariably from, you know, people who were in their 60s and 70s and said, please sing this song or that song because, you know, we heard that song back when we were kids.
But he started writing his own songs and keeping his own songbook. What were the songs that were more political in nature that he started introducing on the radio?
Well, some of the songs that were more political in nature, not political in the ways that the people that celebrate Woody Guthrie would like you to believe. I mean, like, he wrote a song called "The Chinese and the Japs," which was about Japan's invasion of China, and the political statement was, "I don't care, you know, I don't care who's at fault, and I don't care who's bombing who, as long as they don't bomb us." He later said that he regretted that. He also wrote, but his most effective ones were about things that he saw, like when the Los Angeles police set up these totally outrageous barricades at the California border, not allowing Okies or anybody into the state unless they had $50. He wrote a song called "Do Re Mi," which addressed that situation. He also wrote his first talking blues during that time called "Talking Dust Bowl," which might well have been his most effective form because he had a lousy voice. He didn't sing very well. As a matter of fact, he talked more melodiously than he sang. And the talking blues allowed him to kind of talk rhythmically. It was an old black form. And he used it in a narrative style to describe the journey west.
You mentioned this war song as a song whose politics might disappoint a lot of Woody Guthrie's fans. Now, another story that you tell that I think would really disappoint a lot of people is how he used to sing a lot of songs about niggers with the word nigger in it, and it wasn't until he got a letter that it dawned on him, gee, maybe there's something wrong with this.
Yeah, he got a letter from a student at UCLA, a black college student, said that, you know, nice people don't use that word. And apparently, according to Lefty Lou, it just struck Woody completely by surprise. He couldn't imagine that. And so he staged this public ceremony where he ripped up all the nigger songs in his songbook. You know, you could hear the pages ripping on the microphones on the air.
Was it that he didn't realize the negative impact of the word, or that he wasn't, or did he espouse the sentiments that we associate with the word nigger?
I think it was a little bit of both. I think that he espoused those sentiments because he wrote some poetry during that time that was really racist. But also, in another way, it was kind of innocent because I think that, you know, if he knew that when he found out that people were really offended by this, then he immediately stopped doing it.
Mm-hmm. So this was a time when his politics were, I guess, as far as the Dust Bowl refugees, pretty right on, but as far as a lot of other things, that his politics would change a lot as time
Well, he grew continually throughout his life. I mean, he was always changing, and he was always a little bit more difficult than you'd want to believe to pin down. And that's what made him a lot more interesting a figure for me than I expected that he would be. I mean, he was always completely unpredictable. Although there were certain basic principles that were always there.
Did you get to see any footage of him in concert? I don't know. I have
no,
never
I'll tell
seen
you a funny
him.
Story.
I don't know if there's any film.
I'll tell you a funny story. There was only one piece of film that existed. It was a kind of black and white thing of him singing with, I think, Pete Seeger in a short film. And he was just standing there singing, and it sounded a lot like a record, and I didn't get a sense of him. And you know, he seemed, even after living with him as intimately as I did and reading all of his most intimate thoughts, it was still hard to believe that such a guy actually existed because his life was so incredible. And toward the end, someone from New Jersey sent in a little roll of 8mm color film, you know, that watery kind of color from the late 40s. Woody was playing a political cause party in a backyard in New Jersey. And they sent it in. They sent this film in to Marjorie Guthrie, Woody's second wife, and I saw it. And there he was, moving and walking and talking. And it was the first time that it really, you know, that there was, to my mind, incontrovertible proof that the guy actually existed. You know, it was hard to believe up until then.
What struck you about the way he looked? I remember there's one point we were talking about. It's Lefty Lou who says that she used to hang around with him a lot outside of doing the show, but she always thought of him as someone who was very asexual, and it wasn't until she overheard him talking to her father about making love to a woman once that she realized, he's a sexual being.
I think that's more of a testament to Lefty Lou's naivete than the Woody's sexuality. But because he really went to town when he came to New York. But the thing that struck me about the movie that I saw of him was that he seemed softer, more sensitive than I expected. He didn't seem as Southwestern as I thought he'd look. He looked a little bit like John Garfield or something. He had, a short guy with curly hair and very fine features in his face. His clothes seemed, about two sizes too big for him, as they always did. Although there are other pictures of him in the Southwest where he really does look kind of Southwestern. He certainly always sounded Southwestern.
Joe Klein is my guest if you're just tuning in, and he's written a new biography of Woody Guthrie called Woody Guthrie: A Life, so we're talking about Woody Guthrie now. His politics, as you mentioned before, did change a lot, and he became a communist for a while and started hanging around with a lot of the communist folk singers of the time. Well, what does it mean when we say he became a communist? What philosophy came with that?
I think it means both more and less than you'd expect it to mean. In Woody's case, he was a communist. I mean, he stuck by the party line all the way through. I mean, one of the last things that he wrote in the hospital in 1956, 57, just before he couldn't write anymore, was a ringing support of the communists in the 1956 elections, because he said Dwight Eisenhower was a racist. And so he stayed with it. And he read the Daily Worker. He wrote for the Daily Worker. He kept in tune with all the ins and outs of the intricacies of Communist Party politics. As a matter of fact, one of the things that got him into trouble on the radio, in the movie, there was the movie of Bound for Glory, which was Woody's autobiography, which he called his novel, which I think is very significant because
he was ahead of his time. Everybody does that now.
Yeah, well, because his autobiography really is has a lot of emotional truth to it, but not actual truth to it. In the movie, it made it seem as if he were under a lot of pressure in Los Angeles to not sing political stuff. But the station he worked for was owned by a kind of left-wing guy who allowed Woody to sing almost anything he wanted until the Hitler-Stalin Pact came down. And that's kind of significant for now, because when Hitler and Stalin signed their non-aggression treaty, Hitler used it as a license to invade Poland from the east, from the west. And meanwhile, Russia moved into Poland from the east, which isn't as well publicized nowadays. But Woody wrote a talking blues called More War News, in which he celebrated this fact and celebrated the Russian armies liberating Poland and how happy the farmers must have been. And so, in that sense, he was a communist. He really bought the whole thing. He didn't believe in free enterprise. He thought that the people should own the means of production, and from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. But at the same time, he was a lousy communist. I mean, if you put him into a room with Joe Stalin and asked him to sing a song, I'm sure that he wouldn't last through one verse before Stalin would pack him off to the gulag, because he was so undisciplined and so free and so rebellious against any kind of authority, whether it be capitalist, communist, or whatever. Or what have you.
Who were the other singers who he was with at this time who were also involved in left-wing politics and used their music for political occasions?
Well, I guess, he really started to do it full-time after he came to New York in 1940. And the people that he was singing with then included Pete Seeger, who was then 21 years old, and trying to pass himself off as a proletariat, as Woody used to say.
What was he really? That
he was the son of a
off?
Very distinguished ethnomusicologist, Charles Seeger, and he was actually Pete Seeger was in John Kennedy's class at Harvard, although he dropped out. And there were a lot of other people during that time, like Lee Hayes and Millard Lampel, who were also trying to become proletariats, and they used Woody as their role model, and they would invent rural proletarian past for themselves, like Millard Lampel, who came from Paterson, New Jersey, often claimed to come from West Virginia, except for when he forgot and said he came from Kentucky. And the four of them, Lee Hayes, Millard Lampell, Pete Seeger, and Woody Guthrie, formed a group, which was really the first folk music, urban folk music group. And they called themselves the Almanac Singers. And they lived in a commune in Greenwich Village in 1941, which is fairly outrageous. As a matter of fact, you know, this is how one of the reasons why they get into trouble with the Communist Party is because the Communist leadership was kind of puritanical, and the idea of all these people living together with all these women who went around wearing peasant dresses and licked envelopes for the Almanac Singers was kind of outrageous to the party. But during the summer of 1941, the Almanac Singers made this incredible tour, cross-country tour. 1941, there were more strikes in America, more people on strike than in any other year except for 1919. And so you could take a map of the country and put pins in it and go from strike to strike to strike to strike. And that's what the Almanac Singers would do. And they would go into a town. They were incredibly fertile. They would just make up songs as they went along, just in any situation. And Woody was, of course, excellent at this. This was, you know, what he was known for. You know, when he'd forget a verse to a song, it was no big problem because he'd just invent a new one as it went along. And Millard Lampell was also very good at this, and they would sing songs like Woody's Union Maid, and Lampell and Seeger wrote Talking Union Blues, and then there would be songs about each individual strike. And it was the kind, a lot of young folk singers in the years afterwards would try and replicate this, but it was never really able to do it again because they were actually out there on the picket lines and they were actually having some effect.
Well, I know my share of organizers and folk singers who had it all planned that they were going to go inspire the working class and found out that that they hadn't been part of a factory life and that the people who were working in factories were extremely alienated by them. I've seen that happen. No, did they ever meet with any hostility on the lines?
Oh, yeah. They were, well, you know, there's a Mel Tillis song called Detroit City about an auto worker that comes up from Kentucky to the assembly lines. And I think that a lot of the success of the Almanac Singers was attributable to the fact that a lot of the working class in the Middle West at that point were people who had come off of the farms and hadn't gone to California and become migrant farm workers, but had become factory workers in Detroit and Chicago and places like that. But when they hit, you know, some unions in New York, like there's a great story that Arthur Stern, who was a later member of the group, tells about the Almanac Singers playing for the Meat Cutters Union and the Meat Cutters Union annual dinner. And the Almanac Singers would show up at places wearing, you know, they began the tradition, I guess, that really came to the fore in the 60s of dressing down. I mean, they would wear work shirts and dungarees and things like that. And they showed up at this meat cutter's annual banquet, all slovenly dressed, and the meat cutters were all wearing suits and ties, and the women had gotten permanents and so on, and they were outraged that these slobs would come and, you know, kind of sing down to them like that, so they started throwing plates at them, and the Almanacs were forced to run off the stage.
It's interesting, because it's interesting to hear that that's an old tradition in a way.
Well, I think that's where the tradition starts. You know, one of the most significant things about Woody Guthrie, as significant as his music, I think, is the fact that he predicted the 60s so perfectly. I mean, he combined, radical politics with Eastern religion and with this kind of bellicose informality.
But you've got all these people in the 60s who are trying to be as folky as Pete Seeger really was, when if you look back before that, as you pointed out, Pete Seeger was trying to be folky like Woody Guthrie was, or like the folk type should.
And Woody was trying to be as folky as the communists wanted him to be, you know, or expected him to be. He was putting on an act as the ultimate proletarian for them and really seeming to be a lot less sophisticated than he was. There was a guy, Ed Robin, who worked for the People's World, which was the communist paper in Los Angeles, and had a radio show on the same station as Woody, and who brought Woody into the Communist Party and started him playing at fundraising parties and stuff like that. And to this day, Ed Robin cannot believe that Woody Guthrie ever read a book. And the man, you know, was tremendously well-read. He has this huge library that Arlo has, in which Woody, you know, very carefully kept notes on, you know, every page of the book.
You said that there was some conflict between the leftist folk singers of that time as to whether one needed to experience the subject before writing or singing a song about it. So I guess Woody Guthrie was for them the example of the person who had really experienced what he wrote about. Can you tell us a little more about that conflict?
Well, the conflict was mostly between Woody Guthrie and Millard Lampel. Lampel coming from Paterson, New Jersey, and pretending that he was a proletarian. And I think Woody kind of resented the fact that Lampel was so good at it. I mean, he was really fast. He wrote terrific lyrics. And, Woody would argue that you'd have to be able to experience something before you did it. And Lampel would say, does that mean you have to be run over by a railroad train to write about, the horrors of railroad travel? And there were other people like Gordon Friesen and Sis Cunningham came up from Oklahoma to join the Almanac Singers, and they really had lived a hard life. And Friesen was finally the first person that could put any kind of controls on Woody, because he'd say, Woody, you never picked a grape in your life. You never, if you ever tried to work a jackhammer, it would knock you over. You're an intellectual, you're a poet, you're not a worker. And Friesen loved him for what he was, but he didn't like all this putting on.
In talking about this conflict between Lampel and Guthrie, you write some parody lyrics that Lampel wrote for Guthrie's The Great Historical Bum.
Written by Arthur Stern, and it was a parody of Woody's song The Great Historical Bum. And Stern's lyric was, my name is Woody Guthrie, the great hysterical bum, highly saturated in whiskey, rye, and rum. I wrote a million pages but never read a one, and that's about the biggest thing that Guthrie's ever done. So you see, even Arthur Stern bought it at that point. I mean, Lampel talks about hiding his books under the bed because if he were seen reading a book, he would seem too intellectual. And Woody kind of imposed this anti-intellectuality, this, rampant proletarianism, rampant Okieism on the rest of the group.
Well, then you've got Alan Lomax entering into the picture, and he was like capturing for the benefit of history and his records folk people like Lead Belly and I think Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, and he'd interview sometimes the people for the records. Mm-hmm. What were the nature of those interactions like between Lomax and Guthrie, and how seriously do you take the interviews that they recorded?
Well, Lomax was a great promoter, and Lomax invented folk music. I mean, Woody Guthrie never knew that the stuff that he was singing was called folk music until he came to New York and Lomax told him so. But for Lomax, Woody was a revelation. He heard Woody singing in February of 1940 on the stage of the Forest Theater. It was a benefit for the Okies. It was called a Grapes of Wrath evening. Woody called it a Rapes of Graft evening. And Lomax was amazed. Because Woody was to Lomax the ultimate American frontier ballad writer, and Lomax was convinced that no one like that was still living. The guy that wrote Jesse James, no one knows the name of that person, or the person that wrote Sam Bass, and here was a guy on the stage, Woody Guthrie, who could have written all those. And indeed, when Lomax began to speak to him, he found that Woody had written about a half dozen songs that were classics, right there. Right, already. And so Lomax brought him down to Washington, and with half an eye to starting a radio series in which they would both star, began, making records with him at the Library of Congress, which were later released, and which weren't released actually until 1964 as a three-record set. And you can hear it. And he interviewed Woody, and he had Woody sing some of his songs. And it's the most extensive recording of Woody's voice, I think, that exists. I think the most valuable part of it is listening to him talk, because he's a spellbinder. But that ran in the family. I mean, Woody's dad, Charlie Guthrie, was the best talker in Okemo, Oklahoma. When he'd go to the drugstore every morning at 10 o'clock for a cup of coffee, crowds would gather just to hear him talk. And anybody who ever heard Alice's Restaurant knows how Arlo talks.
There was, I don't know if it's this period or a little later, that Guthrie started performing sometimes with Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, and it was a period where people like Pete Seeger were performing on stage with Lead Belly, and there was a mixing of black and white musicians and singers. How did that go over with the audiences of the time? Because surely that was also a very difficult thing.
Well, it went
jazz
over very
when
well.
Races started combining.
It went over very well with left-wing audiences, which were about the only audiences that you could get in those days if you were a folk singer. But although not so well sometimes. Lead Belly was taken to the Camp Unity, which was the Communist Party summer retreat, and he started singing songs about high yaller women and stuff like that, and the crowd was outraged, and Earl Robinson, who had brought him, told him, that kind of stuff doesn't go here. So he came back and sang Bourgeois Blues, and the crowd loved it. But Woody would sing with Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, and he would always kind of sandwich himself in the middle. So you'd have these two black guys and little white Woody Guthrie in the middle like an Oreo. And there was one time where they played together in Baltimore, where they sang together and for a union audience, and the union people really, you know, got off on it apparently. And then afterwards they were going to sit down and have dinner with everyone, and Sonny and Brownie were led over to a separate table, and Woody went over to sit down with them, and they said, "You can't do that. You know, people, black and white, don't eat together here." And Woody's response was to turn over the table where all the food was, the buffet table, and just storm out of there.
Joe Klein is my guest. If you're just joining us, we're talking about Woody Guthrie, which is the subject of his new book, Woody Guthrie, A Life. Was there a point where he officially left the Communist Party or
No.
You know, officially stopped being a communist?
He kind of went in and out of it. There was a point where he didn't make much of it. Like in 1940, he was really very successful, had a chance to be tremendously successful in network radio. He was making $400 or $500 a week, which was a fortune in those days. And he got a job as the host of a program called It's Pipe Smoking Time, which was sponsored by the Model Tobacco Company. And he took So Long It's Been Good to Know You, one of his most famous songs, and he turned it into a jingle for pipe tobacco. So much for all those people who say that Woody Guthrie would never compromise. And he dropped his column in the Daily Worker because it wouldn't do to have a network radio personality who also had a column in a communist newspaper. And he was the host for about 2 or 3 weeks until he got sick of all the restrictions and took off on the road again.
You interviewed so many people for this book, and you know, most of the people, a lot of the people who are written about in the book are still alive, including Lee Hayes and Pete Seeger and a lot of the leftist folk singers. How have they reacted to the way you've described the period and the politics of the time?
Well, they don't like it that much. I mean, both Pete Seeger and Lee Hayes have raised objections to the book because I'm sure that in about 10 or 15 or 20 years, my kids are going to go up into the attic and look at the files of the things that I was writing in the late 60s about the revolution coming tomorrow and how the students were going to be, students were in the vanguard and how, you know, and all that kind of crap. And they're going to say to me, "How could you write that stuff?" And I'm going to say, "But you don't understand. You're oversimplifying." And they're going to say, "But that's ridiculous." And I'm going to say, "But you don't understand. The government was burning babies." And to a certain extent, that's what's gone on with the with people like Seeger and Hayes and so on. They're embarrassed. They're embarrassed. They're embarrassed that during the time of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, they wrote peace songs, and then as soon as Germany invaded Russia, they started writing war songs. They're embarrassed about the fact that they were taken in by Joe Stalin and by the communists during those years. I think that, you know, there's a famous story about Pete Seeger where he wrote, within 2 months of each other, he wrote a song condemning Franklin Roosevelt and a song hailing Franklin Roosevelt. And the event that changed, you know, his opinion of Franklin Roosevelt was the invasion of Russia.
Have you had direct contact with him? Have they told you these things firsthand?
Yeah.
At great length. There's not going to be any official action, angry action taken.
No, I don't think so. I think that that they will just let it be. Another thing that kind of bothered them, I think, was the fact that I got beyond the myth in this book. I mean, I got to a version of the reality, because you can never really, you know, replicate reality in a book. But the fact is that Lee Hayes was especially upset by the reprinting of a lot of Woody's letters, especially after he became affected by the disease, and he began to write these, what I thought, just beautifully written erotic letters. And he did time in jail for writing them, and I included them in the book. And there was some sense that this was disrespectful to the myth of Woody Guthrie. And I don't think so. I think that it fleshes him out. It makes him into a comprehensible human being. And I think that the myth was kind of simplistic and
dumb.
Well,
you found the myth boring.
Yeah, well, I think...
Because you knew the myth before you started really finding out about him.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that kind of really aggressive innocence of the myth, and Woody had a good deal to do with the establishment of this myth. He was a lot more interesting person than that.
To write a lot of this book, you needed the assistance of Marjorie Mazier, who was one of, I think, the second wife of mm-hmm. Woody Guthrie, and a lot of the very erotic but bizarre letters that he sent
were to her.
I think that it took a lot of
courage.
I mean, how many people would let letters like that to them be printed? And all, I mean, her own erotic feelings or her own confusion about sexuality are also written about in here. How did you get her trust and cooperation for the book?
I don't know. It beats me. I mean, it was a remarkable circumstance. There was something about me that she found that she trusted. And her reaction to the book has been very interesting. She is very, very favorable toward the book, although she says that there are things that she disagrees with and things, interpretations that would be different. And of course, when you live through something with someone, your impression of it is always going to be different than someone who comes along afterwards. But I mean, the woman showed a remarkable amount of courage. Not only did she give me all this stuff, but she put down no restrictions. She didn't edit the book before it was published. She asked for no financial consideration. The only thing she asked for was I give her a plug now and then for her committee to combat Huntington's disease, which I'm now doing, which is in New York City. I mean, she's devoted her life to try and help solve the riddle of that disease.
What about Arlo Guthrie? What has he said about this book? Is in a way it all starts back with him when you were doing a feature for Rolling Stone about him.
Arlo's reaction has been absolutely favorable. He thanked me for giving him his grandparents. He never knew about his grandfather, Charlie Guthrie, or his grandmother, Nora Guthrie. And also, I think it hit him in a way, because he didn't know what his father was going through, the precise feelings that his father was going through during the years, during his early 30s, the years that Arlo is going through now. One of the things that comes out in the book is that Woody was aware that he could get that disease that begins to manifest itself when you're in your 30s. When he was in the war, most people don't know that Woody Guthrie was a war hero. He was torpedoed twice when he was in the Merchant Marine. One night when they were under this submarine attack and it looked like he was going to go under, he told Cisco Houston and Jimmy Longy, his two close friends, that his mother had the disease and he thought he was going to get it too because he felt queer sometimes. And so for Arlo, seeing how Woody reacted during those years was very poignant. And there was another thing that was really upsetting to Arlo. I had to tell Arlo that Woody beat him, because when the disease was beginning to take hold and Woody was beginning to lose control of himself, he brutalized his kids, and Arlo was less than two at the time and didn't know about it, didn't remember it, and before I put it in the book, I told Arlo about it just to kind of let him know that it was coming, and that was a very emotional and sad thing for him to know.
Well, I'm certainly very glad that you did all the research that you did and have given all these stories to us. So thank you also for being here this afternoon, Joe Klein. It's been really interesting to talk with you. Thank you.
Okay.
I've been speaking with Joe Klein, and his new book is called Woody Guthrie, A Life. It's published by Knopf. And we have some time left so we can listen to some more of Woody Guthrie's records. It's 10 minutes to 5 o'clock. So let's start with another pretty well-known one. This is called If You Ain't Got the Do-Re-Mi.
Lots of folks back east, they say, is leaving home every day, beating a hot old dusty way to the California line. Across the desert sands they roll, getting out of that old dust bowl. They think they're going to a sugar bowl, but here's what they find. Now the police at the port of entry say, you're number 14,000 for today. Oh, if you ain't got the do-re-mi, folks, you ain't got the do-re-mi. Why, you better go back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. California is a garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or see. But believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got the do-re-mi. You want to buy you a home or farm that can't deal nobody harm, or take your vacation by the mountains or sea. Don't swap your old cow for a car, you better stay right where you are. You better take this little tip from me, 'cause I look through the want ads every day, but the headlines on the papers always say, if you ain't got the do-re-mi, boys, you ain't got the do-re-mi, why, you better go back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. California is a garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or see. But believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got the do-re-mi. Been good to know you so long, been good to know you so long. It's been good to know you, this dusty old dust is a blowing me home. I've got to be rolling along. I'll sing this song, but I'll sing it again, of the place that I lived on the West Texas plains. In the city of Pampa, the county of Gray, here's what all of the people there say. Well, it's so long, it's been good to know you, so long, it's been good to know you, so long, it's been good to know you. Dusty old dust is a blowing me home. I've got to be drifting along. Anyway, like I told you, the old dust storm hit there. These people all congregated in their little houses. And in the room in the house that I was in, there was 12 or 15 people. And while we was there, telling each other so long, it's been good to know you. Dusty old dust is blowing me home, and I ain't got long to stay. I've got to be drifting along. Well, here's what happened. The telephone rang and it jumped off the wall. That was the preacher paying his call. He said, look at the shape that the world is in. I've got to cut price on salvation and sin. So long, been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is driving me home, and I've gotta be drifting along. The church houses were jammed and packed. People was sitting from front to the back. It was so dusty, the preacher couldn't read his text. So he folded his specs and he took up collection. Said, so long, it's been good to know you. So long, been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is rolling me home.
gotta be drifting along.
Woody Guthrie from one of the Library of Congress recordings, and Joe Klein, who joined us earlier, has written a book about Woody Guthrie called Woody Guthrie, A Life. It's 3 minutes to 5 o'clock, and we'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for this evening's edition of All Things Considered, and I'm sure they'll have a number of stories about John Lennon and the murder last night. We'll be featuring a special one-hour program about John Lennon at 7 o'clock, from 7 until 8 o'clock, right after 91 Report, and it's produced by National Public Radio by their news and their cultural programming departments. In the meantime, I'd like to tell you about what's coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. At 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by Philadelphia-based novelist Arthur Salmson, and his new novel is called A Princess in Berlin, and it takes place in Germany between the wars. We'll also be joined tomorrow by Emma and Dolores Lewis, who are the daughters of Lucy Lewis, who's a Pueblo potter, who's considered to be one of the most eminent potters in the Indian tradition. So that's all coming up tomorrow.